Tonight's chat should be very interesting. We've not only got one, but two, but three guest speakers. And yeah, it's going to be really interesting talking about exercise and how to prepare for personal events like marathon running or things like that. So yeah, it's going to be interesting hearing from Nusrat, Rob and Pa and hearing their perspective.
Let's get going and welcome along Nusrat Path, Rob.
Hello.
Hey Rob,
Hi.
how's it going?
It's going fine, thank you. A bit warm.
Good, good. It is a bit warm indeed, isn't it? I hope you've got a nice refreshing drink beside you to keep you going for the next hour. Hey Nusrat.
Hi everyone, you all right?
Yeah, good, thank you. And hey Path.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's nice to see you all here. So, why don't we, for a couple of minutes, we'll go one by one. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourselves? Why don't we start with right at the beginning of where it all began? Tell us a bit about you and your career background, of how you got into diabetes, why diabetes, and what sort of things you do in your career now. So, Nusrat, should we start with you?
Of course, why not? Yeah, so I am a diabetes dietitian. I actually currently work in a primary care network as a dietitian in PCNs, but yeah, I started off sort of working as a dietitian in hospitals and sort of working in secondary care as a diabetes dietitian about 4 or 5 years ago. And I was always quite interested in type 1 diabetes, working with young adults in the sort of secondary care setting in hospitals. Did a little bit of paediatrics, and I think I've talked about this before in the group, but I've done quite a bit of volunteering with Diabetes UK on some of the children's events that they run. So I tend to go and do maybe a camp a year or a weekend a year where I support children with type 1 to do some sports and exercise on the camp. And that's sort of what's fascinated me really about the diabetes, seeing that side of it. And then afterwards, I think post-COVID, there were some jobs going in primary care networks. So I actually switched jobs to work in the primary care with GP surgeries. And I focused actually recently just on low-carb diets, very low-carb diets, and helping people sort of put diabetes into remission through sort of eating and diet and lifestyle. And I met Robin Path maybe, I can't remember, was it just before COVID, wasn't it? The month before COVID. And we talked about setting up maybe something where we can educate and support people with type 1 diabetes who do sports, because we realized there was a bit of a gap. Rob and Path have obviously been working in this area for a while, but we were aware that there's not a lot of support for medics or other people. So we actually, myself and Molly and a couple of other dietitians, have set up a group called BDA as part of the BDA, so British Dietetic Association. We set up a group called for dietitians to sort of support them, and we were sort of planning to do some podcasts and support and a bit, a bit of this, just general chats and getting people on to talk. And that's kind of what brought me, Rob and Path and Molly and these guys together. And that's kind of me at the moment, I think. Let someone else talk.
Brilliant, thank you. What about you, Pa?
Hi, so I'm based in Birmingham. I'm a doctor who looks after adults with type 1 diabetes, and I also spend some of my time doing research. I'm about to half and half. So my background is really interested in the immunology and why people get type 1 diabetes. What happens to the immune system that makes it want to sort of damage the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas and what starts it off. And then, so I've been interested in that in some time. There's lots of trials in this area. But what made me start talking to Rob was an observation that we'd both had, that people who exercise seem to have much longer honeymoons. And also studies in type 2 diabetes suggesting that exercise preserves these insulin-producing beta cells. So we sat down over a coffee at a conference in Scotland about 12 years ago. Rob, you can correct me. And we said, why don't we see if exercise preserves beta cells in people with type 1 diabetes? And when people are diagnosed with type 1, they've still got some beta cells at the time they're diagnosed. So we did this trial called XTOD, Exercise for Type 1 Diabetes, to explore if exercise can preserve these cells. And to cut a long story short, if the measure is correct, if you're measuring the insulin production correctly in the correct manner, adjusting for the other changes that happen with exercise, then there is some evidence that it benefits. But the main thing that came out of that was that as we were going around trying to recruit patients to the study and support healthcare professionals to deliver the study, we realized that actually quite a lot of people don't know how to support patients to exercise. I think Rob's known this for some time and he's been doing some courses in the background. But that was my sort of background. And then so that led on to something much bigger, which is the XDOD course and the conference and all of this, which you may have heard of. So that's just carried on. So that's my background and how I got into this.
Thank you. What about you, Rob?
So I'm like Parth. I'm a diabetes doctor that I work in at Taunton, which is in the southwest. And then I do half time taking care of people with diabetes and half time doing research. So I've been qualified 32 years, and I really got into this in my first year. So I was a reasonable swimmer, reasonably good swimmer. And when my colleagues I used to swim with found that I was a doctor, they used to send me athletes who had problems. And the first four or five people that they sent me to try and help were some swimmers with diabetes. And I just got very interested in it, particularly how little was known at the time to support these people. And that's really what got me into exercise and diabetes. So I've continued in there. I support a lot of elite athletes or just standard people who want to run marathons or do things for the first time. And then that's led to doing research in the area to try and know more, to further fuel that we can give better advice.
Sounds absolutely incredible. And we look forward to tonight to talking a little bit more about exercise and managing how we can train. So before we do that, just a few sort of other questions. What do you love about your job the most, and what challenges do you face, and what fascinates you the most about diabetes, and why do you want to help improve the quality of people's lives? So should we start with Rob, and we'll go your way around this time?
I suppose what I love about my job is each day is different, apart from the brief spell we had COVID when it was COVID every day. But generally, it's very different. I get to meet a variety of people. And particularly from the exercise point of view, I've had a number of people who've been told that they can't do because they've got diabetes. And it's really great when you meet them and say, actually, you can do it. You just need a bit of support, but you can do whatever you want. And it's fabulous when they go off and do it and then come back and say, oh, I did it. It was wonderful. And that's the best feedback you can have in any job.
What sort of challenges would you say you face in your line of work?
Same challenges that I suppose everyone does, where, you know, the NHS doesn't always have the money to give everybody what they want to do. And that can be quite distressing when you're fighting to get something that you know someone really wants, and can be frustrating. And certainly over the last, I don't know, the same with Parth, but over the last couple of years being dragged away from our specialties to do COVID, I could understand that at the beginning. But I think from a diabetes point of view, we still seem to be at the front end, and all the other specialties have got back to it. So it almost underlying that the NHS doesn't believe that people with diabetes are as important as other people, which I think, you know, more needs to be said about that, because that's very unfair.
Of course, yeah. Parth, what about you? What do you love most about your job, and what challenges do you face, and what fascinates you the most about diabetes?
So I think what fascinates me is that just losing one hormone makes such a difference. So, you know, we have thousands of hormones floating around controlling different things, but just losing one type of cell in the pancreas very specifically. So the islets are, you know, 1 or 2% of our pancreas volume. And even within that, the beta cells that make insulin is even less. But losing that makes such a difference to people's lives. Luckily, we have insulin replacement now, but it's not as, injecting it is not as, it's difficult to reproduce what happens in the beta cell, the sort of second by second change in insulin secretion that's needed to control glucose. So, you know, the fact that our patients go through, they have to go through so much to control their blood glucose, all the monitoring and insulin replacement, carb counting, all of that. And it is said it's one of the, it's a condition where we, there's no other condition where we ask as much of our patients. So the challenge that people go through in terms of monitoring and insulin replacement is often unseen. You know, people don't realize what patients are going through. But actually, it's a lot of effort that people go through, and it's all due to just one cell, the loss of one cell type.
That's so interesting.
That's what interests me. And like Rob, it's work pressure, really. I think diabetes is it's a fascinating condition, and really, the reward is, you know, particularly if you take something like exercise, just people could be struggling with it for a long time, and you just give them a simple piece of advice, and then suddenly it just changes everything. They understand what's going on, and they can start exercising again. So you get very quick feedback, which is really nice to see. And when you explain principles, which are fairly often can be quite simple, you can make a big change to people's lives, and that reward of seeing that's really nice.
And Nusra?
Yeah, I mean, working with people and patients, I mean, that's definitely what I would love about my job. It's great. And I think the most challenging part of the job is people also, because they're not straightforward to work with, and there's always something different going on. And I think from a diet point of view, you know, there's always likes and dislikes. People are very different. There's loads of cultural stuff, you know, just in like even the area, like the differences in Scotland to England to London, the food just varies. So every person is very different. So yeah, for me, the challenges tend to be people. And what do I love is working with people and helping people. And I think the fascinating thing about diabetes is, as Rob and Pav said, it's a really complex disease, and it does affect people differently. But, you know, it's great to sort of work with people and find out what motivates them to change, or, you know, helping them make differences. And I think diet is quite a key cornerstone for diabetes. So as a dietitian involved in diabetes, mm-hmm. you really feel like you can make a difference. And, you know, when you're giving that first person who's been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes advice about carb counting, you're making that initial difference. And so that is massively rewarding. So, yeah, it's always fascinating. And the new evidence is coming out, and the different things and the different insulins, the new medications. There's always something new and interesting about diabetes going on. New technology, so it always can kind of keep you interested. And as a clinician, when you're sort of working quite a number of years in different areas, so yeah, the pancreas is definitely something that's fascinated me in my career, and an area of interest, really.
Fantastic, guys, what an amazing start to the evening. A nice little introduction about you guys, what you get up to. And a few comments coming through already on the hashtag. James says, really great hearing the exercise T1D experts. I am truly thankful for their resources, research, and education in the niche area, which has given me confidence to push myself further with my exercise and running. So thank you very much. And Gillian comments back to you, Parth, says, fascinating listening to Parth about exercise extending honeymoon duration. I'm attempting to achieve that, diagnosed as a mature adult nearly 3 years ago, and try and average 50 minutes exercise every day, and definitely still in the honeymoon phase. Long may it continue. So what we'll do is we've got some questions which we will ask throughout the course of the evening. Chris is going to head up the first couple of sections. Over to you, Chris.
All right. So we're going to start with things, sort of the pregame, prepping before someone starts an exercise regimen. And I guess I'll just throw the first one out there. And that is, should someone consult with their GP or their diabetes specialist before they start an exercise regimen or start training for an event like a marathon or some sort of athletic competition that they're going to be participating in?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So generally, exercise is a good thing, and is actually something we would use to in part of managing people who've got some of the things that go with diabetes. So just to clarify, things like, you know, heart disease, exercise on prescription, exercise is there to as part of rehab after heart disease, after stroke, it's there. So exercise generally is a good thing, and there are very few barriers. If we think about the things specific to diabetes that we may need to watch out for, so in people who've got eye disease, there are very few eye conditions that should prevent you exercising. So if you've got eye disease where you're seeing an ophthalmologist, an eye specialist, if there's proliferative eye disease or if there's severe eye disease, non-proliferative eye disease, then certain types of exercises like vigorous or resistance exercises may be contraindicated. So that's eye disease. For neuropathy, so where there's nerve damage, and often nerve damage affects the longest nerves first, so often the feet. If people can't feel the feet, then weight-bearing exercises can potentially cause a bit of harm that people can't feel. So they need to examine their feet regularly, make sure they're wearing the right footwear. Particularly if pain sensation affected, you can understand that you need to watch out for that. If there's an open injury or a sore, then weight-bearing exercises is contraindicated. But remember, there's lots of non-weight-bearing exercises. There's swimming, there's upper body exercises that people can do. And the benefits are there. You know, all the cardiometabolic benefits are there for those as well. And then for more severe nerve damage, such as autonomic nerve damage, which can affect things like heart rate, your blood pressure, ability to detect hypoglycemia, then clearly that you've got to take more care with. And generally the advice is start gently and gradually increase. For kidney disease, which is a third complication, can be the third complication of diabetes, generally there aren't any contraindications there. Even people have gone where it's been so bad that they've needed a kidney transplant, even there isn't really a contraindication. Actually, there's benefit. So essentially, you know, the general principle is there aren't many things that contraindicate it. Start slowly and increase it gradually. And for the more severe complications, do speak to your doctor before you make a start.
I know there's been discussion in the past about rapid improvements in glycemic control, even sometimes making things like the eye disease worse. Is part of the reason that for the recommendation to start slowly and ease into it?
So any sort of rapid glucose control can make small vessel disease, such as eye, kidney, nerve damage, it can make it worse. But generally to achieve that, often it's insulin much better insulin treatment that does that. It's very unlikely that with exercise you get that improvement in glucose control to cause that sort of damage. I hope that makes it clear.
Thanks. No, that's helpful. And you kind of covered this, but are there any specific sports or activities that people should stay away from? Any restrictions that you can think of that, you know, it might be is a little bit too much.
Yeah, I'll take that if you want, Parth. So it's worth noting just because the history feels. So when I first got into diabetes, there were 27 sports that people with diabetes couldn't do. And gradually with time, we've kind of whittled it down. So when I first started, I don't know if people know, there was something called Gary Hall Jr., who was an Olympic athlete for the USA, who, when he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, was firmly told that he had to give up swimming. And he'd already been a gold medalist once and went on to get another number of other gold medals. And when I first qualified, you weren't able to swim the channel if you had type 1 diabetes. And it took till 1996, so another 6 years, to get permission for the first person with type 1 diabetes to swim the channel. And with time, a lot of us have worked very hard with the different foundations. So in the UK, the only thing you aren't able to do if you've got type 1 diabetes is you still aren't able to be a professional jockey. And we're still working with the jockey club to see whether we can overturn that. But they're really quite a difficult group to work with. Prior to that, the one we had a real trouble on was boxing. And that was overturned 2.5 years ago. So there's now someone called Muhammad Ali, who is someone with type 1 diabetes, who got the first person with type 1 diabetes to get a boxing license. So there are some restrictions that are placed out with. But on the whole, pretty well, people with diabetes can do anything. Sometimes complications do bear things. So if, for instance, you were going to walk to the Antarctic, then unfortunately there will be things that if you have with your diabetes, you aren't able to do that, such as if you had severe neuropathy, then that you wouldn't get signed off to do that. But that's due to the complications of the diabetes. But on the whole, there are no real restrictions. It's worth bearing in mind, just if we're talking about elite sports or people thinking about going into sporting competitions, that insulin is a banned drug. So you have to get that registered up front that you're using it. If you don't register that up front and then obviously are caught using it, then that can do difficulty. So there are some things hurdles you have to jump through. But on the whole, hopefully most of the restrictions have gone.
And that kind of leads us into the planning aspect of getting ready for participating in sport or even just, you know, a normal exercise routine that someone might be taking up. The first thing is different types of exercise. Obviously, you've got aerobic versus anaerobic weight resistance training, that kind of thing. Do those affect things differently?
So yes, that they do. So for, as Parth mentioned at the start, we've developed a course called Xtod Education, and in writing that we tried to keep things really simple, just because I'm a really simple person. So we made a kind of what's called the rule of threes. So in basic language, you can divide exercise into three types of exercise. So there is what we would call flexibility exercises. So the general kind of exercises that people think of that are yoga or Pilates or things like that. So those are exercises where you're trying to stretch the muscles and the tendons and make people more flexible. And those aren't seen by the body as being particularly stressful, and they don't use very much glucose. So on the whole, with those exercises, the glucose doesn't change at all. Then there's the anaerobic exercise, which is generally what a lot of people do. So that's the continuous exercise that you actually do, tends to last longer than 2 minutes in one go, and is done at kind of moderate to moderate intense intensity. You don't tend to do full out. That's perceived as a bit of a risk, a stress for the body. So as well as burning glucose, you also release quite a lot of stress hormones that help you prop up the glucose. But on the whole, because people with type 1 diabetes have slightly more insulin around than people who don't have type 1 diabetes, there's a slight misbalance between how much the liver produces of glucose, even with stress hormones, and how much it's taken up by the muscles. So on the whole, across those events, the glucose can fall. And if the insulin is even a bit higher, it can fall quite a lot across the exercise. So on the whole, glucose tends to fall with those. And then the third one is you have the anaerobic exercises, which are sprinting, weightlifting. There are some odd ones that you kind of wouldn't always think of anaerobic. So like fencing is a kind of anaerobic event, because it's short stopped and then there's a rest and then short stopped. With those, the body really foresees those as a stress, and you release large amounts of stress hormones, and that overpowers any insulin that's around. So the liver releases probably more glucose than the muscles need. So on the whole, the glucose levels tend to go up. And that's fairly common in people who don't have type 1 diabetes, is that glucose can go up with these stressful events, but then they produce a bit more insulin and pull it down before the end. But with people with type 1 diabetes, that can go up across the whole of the exercise, so they finish a bit higher. And then the final thing, which is what the majority of people do, which is that mix, which is going to the gym, doing a bit of running or doing a bit of weights. It depends what the makeup is of those. So if you were completely 50-50, then your glucose wouldn't change. Whereas if you were slightly more of the anaerobic to the running, then it would tend to go up. And obviously, if you're slightly more of the aerobic than anaerobic, it tends to go down. So it's all really judged by the hormone releases and how long the exercise lasts for.
Since the hormones tend to play a big part of this, and we've got obviously hormones that fluctuate throughout the day, you know, the circadian rhythms type of things. Is there one time of day that's better for people to exercise?
Yes. So it was interesting that people were talking about. So there's two things, well, two or three things that govern when's the best time to exercise. The first thing is that if you can ensure that you have as little insulin level around as possible with someone with type 1 diabetes, they can ensure there's as little insulin around as possible, and you can get both of the systems that provide you energy when you exercise which is fat burning and glucose burning. And in fact, people who have type 1 diabetes are much, much better fat burners than the general athlete. So they have an advantage in sort of endurance events. Then you can really get really quite simple control of your glucose across exercise. So the first thing to think about is when is the best time that you've got the lowest insulin levels. And if you look across the day, and I think there's a picture that I kind of drawn of that, that the lowest level that you're going to have, the lowest level of insulin, is first thing in the morning. So actually the safest time to exercise with when your glucose will fall the least and you'll be doing lots of fat burning is to get up first thing in the morning, not have breakfast and go and exercise. And the studies that we've done and other people have done shown is that you can manage 60 to 70 minutes without taking any glucose at all, and the glucose stays pretty steady. And then the other thing you want to think about is, can I use the hormones that I release across the day to protect me from becoming hyperglycemic? And we all have a hormone called cortisol, which is the hormone that wakes you up in the morning. And actually, some nice studies show that the people who are really good in the morning have a very early rise of cortisol, and the people who aren't very good in the morning have a late rise of cortisol. But it's the hormone that wakes you up. But that makes you insulin resistant. So if you can exercise in the morning, you get protected for the 6 or 7 hours after exercise. So you're less likely to have a hypo. Whereas if you exercise in the afternoon, you don't get that advantage. So you're at much higher risk of having hyperglycemia.
All of those hormonal fluctuations and things, I assume that, you know, there's sort of a recovery period in the muscles after they've been used in sucking up glucose and had all these various hormones associated with exercise, you know, pushing sugar in and out. Is there an ideal number of times that people should exercise per week? Is, you know, more always better? Is a daily routine better versus taking a day or two off between intense sessions better to give the muscles some time to recover?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So one of the things that happens when we exercise is that we become more insulin sensitive. So we need less insulin to shift the same amount of glucose out of the bloodstream and into our tissues, whether that be liver, muscle, wherever. So after exercise, people with type 1 and even people without type 1 need less insulin. So the pancreas makes less insulin. And of course, in the context of someone with type 1, they need to inject less insulin. So this can be really troubling. And patients tell us that sometimes managing glucose during exercise is fine. It's the time afterwards that's the real problem, because they need to reduce all their doses, which they may have spent a lot of time getting the ratios and basal doses right, and suddenly they've got to change all of that. So if you exercise regularly, then you stay insulin sensitive, and you don't need to change those basal doses and bolus ratios. Now, you remember that the government guidelines are we should be exercising with no more than 2 days break. And some of that comes from the fact that once you exercise, you remain insulin sensitive for a couple of days, you know. So it's a gradual return to normal, but it can last up to 2 days. So if you can exercise at least every 2 days, you'll keep insulin sensitive, and you don't need to play around with your bolus and basal ratios. So 4 times a week, if you can get it up to 4 times a week, then it's beneficial. If you do it all on a Sunday, which many people do because of time constraints and things, they may find that on the Sunday night and Monday, they have to change their doses, and the rest of the week, they're back to their normal doses, and then they exercise the next Sunday and it comes back down. So doing it regularly is useful. Hope that makes sense. So 4 times a week is beneficial. And as you know, again, at least 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise and 2 strength training. During the week as a total amount.
All right. And then I guess the final question that I have, at least for this section here, is about glucose targets. I know in a lot of the closed loop systems, they actually raise the target ranges when you tell it that you're exercising, when you put it into an activity mode or something like that. Should people be aiming for a slightly higher blood sugar level when they're going in, especially if they're starting going into exercise, just for a little bit of extra cushion or protection? And then obviously that also sort of leads into, you know, should everybody who's doing any exercise like that be on a CGM so that they can keep track of those things a little bit better.
Do you want me to answer that, Path?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so I mean, there's kind of, I suppose there's lots of questions there, but there's a question of what should the glucose be at the start, and generally what most people have kind of agreed is that if it's not 7 when you're starting, then you ought to be having something before, and that if it's less than 5, then you perhaps shouldn't be starting at that point. So there are sort of agreed guidelines that kind of 7 is ideal, because then you don't have to take anything, you can just start exercising. And there's been a lot of debate, but at the moment people are saying be careful if your blood sugar is above 15. So that's the kind of starting kind of at levels that people are suggesting. Once you're into the event, then you're right, just a bit of a cushion is quite good. So the recommendations are that if you have a glucose CGM or a Libra, then you're trying to get it kind of between 7 and 9 is what your kind of target. So you're giving yourself a bit of a cushion and just remembering that they're about 15 minutes behind. If you're on a closed loop, that's quite varied between the closed loops. So some of them have slightly different targets. So they have what's called temp target or activity targets. And those are very helpful, because what they mean is that you don't release, you don't do bonusing at a level that would cause you to drop very quickly. So raising them can be helpful. Studies show that if you have manual control over that, then the best target is to go is for 8.6 in people who have hybrid closed loops, or if they've got DIY loops. So it can be better to do that. And then there's the question after exercise. So after exercise, there is, again, a risk of low blood sugars. So if you had the CGM, we would say just in that first hour, try and just stay away from a lower end. So just pop yourself up, give the lower target 4.4, and then you can return to the normal target. But then overnight, just think, should I set my low alarm target a bit higher? And if you think you're at risk, and you've not got very good hyper-aware, then the higher target should be sort of 5.6. And again, I've done a little diagram kind of showing what that should be across the range. I hope that makes sense.
Rob, can I just add in James's comment? I'm wondering if you could give some generic advice about basal rate reduction for long-distance running. I'm presently up to -75% basal reduction 1 hour pre-morning run, and my recent found glucose still pulling down after around 40 minutes, requiring me to take on board more carbs. What would you recommend in terms of basal reduction, or perhaps wait longer than the hour post basal reduction?
Yeah, so the key bit here, both if you're on a pump, if you're on a hybrid closed loop, is time. So I think we all think that insulin levels drop quite quickly, but they don't. So for instance, if you took your pump off, 2 hours later, you'd still have 50% of your insulin around. So you have to give it time for that to change. So the data shows that for both of them, if you're going to go to the set target or the activity target for if you're on a hybrid closed loop, or if you're going to reduce your basal amount, ideally you should be doing it 90 minutes before. Some people do find that they even have to do it 2 hours if they've got lower body weight and clearance of the insulin isn't as much, but 90 minutes is the bit to start at. And then generally for long distance runners, it's somewhere between 60% and 80% if you're doing that 90 minutes before.
Brilliant. Thank you. I hope that helps, James. All right. Thank you so much, guys, already for a fantastic start to tonight's chat. Sort of subtopic is when and what to eat when taking part in sport and exercise. So first question I've got is, how important is nutrition in sporting performances? And why don't we head over to Nusrat? She's unmuted. She's ready to go.
Thank you. Yeah, nice question. So yeah, I think in terms of for diabetes, as sort of apart from what I've explained, you know, glucose and insulin, you're going to need it. So to sort of fuel the activity you're doing, you're going to need some carbohydrates. And yeah, so you taking in adequate fuel for the activity you're going to do is going to help that, and make sure your sugars don't run too low and you're not going to run too high, and sort of sometimes changing the way you eat the food, so having low GI foods or high GI foods, so glycemic index, and using that to your benefit can be quite helpful if you're trying to fuel for a particular activity. So I think for long distance, mm-hmm. or sort of training for a longer run, especially if you're running for more than a few hours, then yeah, you would need something before, something during to sort of keep your levels up, and probably something after as well to make sure you don't drop too low after. So yeah, really important, I guess, depending on the different sorts of sports. I can't go through all of them today, but yeah, you would probably need to sort of amend that based on your activity and what you know happens. And yeah, everyone's different, because that stress release hormones that we were talking about, everyone's levels will be different, and different people's, you know, we know what happens to most people, but your stress and anxiety before a game or before an event might be so much more than someone else's. So I think it's important, if you are training, to sort of train and practice what would happen and what happens to your levels, you know, before you sort of just go for it at the end. I would say it's quite important to sort of practice.
Yeah. And what would you say happens to your sort of dietary needs and requirements as the more exercise you do and the more fitter you get? Does it change like your sort of dietary plan?
Yeah, I think as obviously if you're doing elite sort of standards, or if you're running quite a long number of hours and you're doing a lot of intense exercise, you probably are going to need a little bit more carbohydrate, and the more your body's going to need a bit more protein as well. So there's loads of numbers we can chuck out. I guess it depends how intense and things you are. But I'd say, like, you know, between 3 to 12 grams of carbohydrate, you know, before a meal. If you were during, you might want to sort of fuel small and often, so smaller snacks are sometimes more handy, sort of prop your sugars up. So little either gels, I guess, depends how, if you're running for a long period, maybe like sports bars, whatever someone tolerates, or little drinks, I guess, like sports drinks that can sort of prop your sugars up. So you're looking at about 10 to 15 to 20 grams of carbohydrate, just trickling it in rather than maybe pushing it up straight away. And then post the same. So once you've done exercise, your body actually absorbs quite a lot of glucose, even without insulin. So that's why sometimes people do have hypos, because your body's just used the insulin better and then you've absorbed a lot of it. So often just having that little bit of a snack afterwards and making sure you've got some carbohydrates can help, especially for aerobic activity. So yeah, I think as you increase and you get fitter, you probably will need to start thinking about how much carbohydrates you're having per hour of that activity. So after meals as well, it might be important to have approximately 1 gram of carbohydrate per your body weight with the meal, and making sure you've got some protein in there, and probably the same sort of before. So yeah, there's quite a lot of numbers, and it's very hard to break down, I guess, on a chat. But any specific questions, we can try and answer.
And what about in terms of how far in advance should you be looking at sort of your meals and snacks? Like, should you be reorganized to ensure that you eat an hour before you run, or 10 minutes before? Is there a plan that you feel we should really look at? Or does it really depend on what sort of sport and exercise you're about to do?
Yeah, I guess in an ideal world, you'd be doing what Rob and Parf were talking about. So maybe trying to sort of get that 90 minutes before and sort of planning it really well. I don't think anyone with type 1 diabetes lives in an ideal world all the time. There's always going to be ups and downs. So yeah, as best as you can plan for something, it will be good, because obviously you need to match your insulin, you sort of need to think about what you're doing, but there's ways around it, I guess. There's three ways of sort of managing your exercise. You can either use diet, you can use insulin, and you can use exercise. So, you know, there's definitely more than one way of managing your food and your diet, depending how and what you've done. But yeah, definitely, I would say it's always better if you can sort of plan it, but it's never going to be possible every single time.
Of course. And because it's quite general tonight, is there any sort of advice or any suggestions of what you'd recommend to maybe eat or drink before, during, and after taking part in sports or exercise? I know there's a lot to that question, but is there any type of foods that you'd really recommend to maybe take before, during, or after?
So yes, I think sort of before, always having a little bit of, maybe, you know, for longer sort of runs and things, thinking about lower GI foods, so foods that aren't going to maybe put your sugars up too quickly. They're going to release their energy a bit slower, so thinking about oats and grains, things like muesli, porridge, that sort of thing, that maybe you've got some nuts to it, or peanut butter or nut butter, that sort of thing. That will be quite slow releasing. So anything that's, you know, lower GI, whole grain, granary bread, pita bread, that might be so some carbohydrates and some protein in there, that will sort of spread out a little bit thinner. during exercise, you're probably looking for things that are going to prop your sugars up a little bit faster. I guess if you're running for a long time or if you're doing a lot of intensity and sprints, you maybe just want to sort of perk it up a bit. So having higher GI foods is a little bit better there. So a little bit more like your gels or sugars. If you like fruit juices, things like that might be good. And things like little sweets, you know, people do have different things that they take, or things like crackers, anything that's got white bread or anything that's made from white flour tends to absorb a lot quicker. I guess, you know, whilst you're running, you're probably not going to be weighed down with loads of stuff. But yeah, whatever sort of works for you that you can tolerate. And you've got to sort of think about your bowels as well. I guess, you know, not everyone is comfortable running and eating at the same time, and that can affect people differently. So having to think about what works for you post after exercise, probably a mixture of the two, sort of it's up to you depending on what your sugars are doing. Having a little bit of protein again with some carbohydrate is usually quite helpful. If you're low, I guess having something higher GI you can use to sort of bring your sugars up. And if you're sort of not so, if you're a bit higher, maybe have some lower GI snacks with some carbohydrates, with some protein as well might be a bit better. So anything like full fat yogurt with berries or that sort of thing, or some cereal, Weetabix, yeah, that sort of thing.
And you talked about before about the pre-meal, say 90 minutes before exercise, ideally. Would you recommend after participating in the sport exercise to, if you're having, say, even a meal or lunch or whatever it is, would you recommend that would be like the 90 minutes after? So like you say, you have your snack or whatever after your exercise, but a sort of meal, would you recommend after a certain point?
Literally, as usually the best, especially if you're sort of working at that elite level, etc. But ideally, as soon as possible after, you know, within an hour. It doesn't matter. 3 or 4 hours later, you're probably going to get less benefits. So that protein and that carbohydrate isn't going to be as beneficial, especially if you're sort of thinking about recovery. So you sort of want to recover, make sure you replenish that carbohydrate that you've used during your run. That'll stop you going, you know, feeling tired after the next day or the day after. So having a decent supply of that carbohydrate going in quite quickly is always a little better. And the protein as well, that'll help your recovery and your muscles. So better is good, but if you can't, it's not going to be the end of the world. You know, usually your body's got that 24-hour sort of window where it's still sort of picking up. But yeah, in an elite athlete sort of level, ideally a little bit closer is always better.
Yeah, no, that's great, that's great. And what about supplements? Should you be taking supplements? Would you recommend supplements, any specific ones, or on any different occasion? What's your thoughts on supplements?
Supplements are always tricky. I think as dietitians, unless you're sort of working, if you're an elite athlete, I would say, and you know that your sort of everything you're eating in your diet is absolutely brilliant, I think a supplement also could be something to talk about with your sort of team, because if you're working at an elite level, then you have to be careful about what you're taking in, and you know, these are drugs. But generally, I think most people, if you're not an elite athlete and you're just day to day, you're probably not going to benefit from supplements, you know, unless you're really, really sort of working at those levels. Personally, I don't know if Rob and Pop, would you say any different? Is there anything else you would say there?
No, I agree. I mean, just to add to what Nurse Rat said, which is always wonderful to hear, saying no so much. But I mean, one, I think someone was talking just like came on about what do you do in this kind of weather. So the really important thing is fluid before, and actually the fluid before doesn't hydrate you. What it does is that if you think about when you start running, what you do is you take the blood away from the stomach, and then you're going to be trying absorbing carbohydrate from the actual stomach. If you can fill the stomach with water before the event, that will stop the blood being taken away from the stomach and mean that your glucose absorption still stays very good. And that's what when the hot weather, if you don't take enough fluid that stays in the stomach, then you start to notice that your glucose drops much quicker, and that's because the blood's being diverted away from the stomach. So it's that 300 mils, you know, from before a normal event, but in hot weather, you're trying to get 400, 500 mils in so that you're just occupying that stomach. You might have to do that over an hour and things, but just that will enable you to keep absorbing the glucose. And then just to say the 90 minutes before is the real problem for people on the hybrid closed loops, because you think about it, well, the last thing you want to do is be having peaks that you're responding to in terms of insulin. So if you have to eat, then please try and eat the very glycemic food and protein before, so you don't have those spikes. Otherwise, you do run into quite a lot of difficulty with the hybrid closed loop if you're eating close to the exercise.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you so much. I hope that's...
I totally forgot about the fluid, even though it's absolutely boiling.
Chris, why don't we head over to you and let's understand a little bit about high glucose levels.
All right. So I think some of this we've kind of at least talked around a little bit, but what's the reason for glucose levels tending to be a little bit higher before matches and events and things that people are doing? Is it stress? Is it something else that's going on hormonally? What's the mechanism there?
Yeah, so so stress stress does affect other hormones, which do put up glucose. So the thing to remember is that when we think of diabetes, we just think of insulin. We don't teach our patients about all the other hormones that are involved in managing glucose and in controlling glucose. So we've got insulin that takes glucose out of the bloodstream and into tissues, and we've got a myriad of other hormones that takes glucose out of tissues and back into the bloodstream. So things like stress, adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol, Rob mentioned earlier, growth hormone, and all of these have an effect of putting glucose up. So anyone with type 1 will know that when they are in a stressful situation, even though they may not be doing any physical exercise, it puts their glucose up. So, and this can be a real problem because people can train and they'll get their training approach correct, but when they go for a competition, even though they're doing the same sort of exercise at the same time of day, haven't taken the same insulin and taking the same carbohydrates, because the stress hormones come into play, it can push the glucose up and make it much more difficult to manage. So those are the reasons that it goes up. So And also, we talked earlier about some exercises putting glucose up and others putting it down. And again, it's the same sort of thing. So some exercises are quite stressful. The anaerobic exercises, resistance exercises, games like squash, weightlifting, archery, all of these are short, sharp exercise forms that end up pushing your glucose up. So that's the reason.
And sometimes blood sugars can, or blood glucose can remain elevated or even trend up after someone finishes an exercise session. Is that related to the hormones shifting around as the glucose demands change? And what should people do if they're on a pump or a hybrid closed loop system to try to manage those effects?
Yeah, it's a good question. And Rob's prepared a slide. I don't know if you can tweet that out for options for managing high glucose before exercise. So that should go with what I've just spoken about. And then your question now, Chris, about what we should do after exercise. So if you're doing anaerobic exercise, you've got the stress hormones that are coming to play and push your glucose levels up, which can stay up after exercise. But also, if you're metabolizing anaerobically, you're going to produce lactic acid. And lactic acid can't hang around forever. It needs to be got rid of. And the way it's got rid of is it goes back into the liver and gets converted into glucose. So suddenly, out of nowhere, you're getting this glucose being generated as part of clearing your lactic acid. So that's the other reason why it goes up as well. So how do you manage that? So the first thing is to rehydrate. You need to do that anyway, as Nusrat will tell you, because you lose fluid when you exercise. You can manage it with a... so that's the first thing to do. The second thing you can do is think about using aerobic exercise to burn off that glucose. So if you have the energy after a squash match, think about a walk home or some sort of cool down if you're in a gym session. To burn that off. And then if you really want to, you could try some insulin for correction, but you've just got to be careful about the risk of hypo that follows. And if you're using insulin to correct, then you're going to be much more insulin sensitive. So use a half to a third of what you normally use to correct, but ideally the first two. And fluid in itself is very effective as bringing down glucose, as many of you will know.
So for people that are on closed loop systems, should they leave the system in sort of that exercise or activity mode, or with the higher temp target for a while, so that they don't get as much of a correction?
So remember, during the exercise, there's less insulin going in. So you could do a couple of things. Generally, the advice is at the end, even though you're going on to your exercise mode 90 minutes before you start exercise, as Rob said earlier, you need to put it back onto your normal mode at the end of exercise rather than wait. But some people can, if they're finding that post-exercise is a problem, they can go back onto temp mode before the end of exercise and judge how long that would be.
And then what about sort of longer after exercise? If not just say immediately after you stop, but say several hours later, is that a different mechanism? Is that, you know, maybe growth hormone stimulating new muscle growth in response to the exercise or something like that? And again, sort of how, is there a strategy to deal with it, or is it really just figure out what works for you?
Sorry, Chris, do you mean high glucose after exercise or
yes, low? Yes, high glucose a few hours after exercise.
I mean, some of it might relate to not having the right amount of, not being on the optimal insulin doses.
So maybe they should resume their normal insulin sooner to help combat that?
Yeah, some of it. So generally, the later high is unfortunately, is that missing window that you gave less insulin kind of catches up with you. So at that point, you might need to do corrections or you might need to change. But what we're saying is that you still need to take slightly less from it. And even if when you're eating, you need to take slightly less. So if, say, you're on a closed loop, the evidence is that for that first meal afterwards, is that the correction is that what you would take with the meal would be 25% less. So you would announce less to the machine in terms of the food, just to delay it kicking in. So it'll kick in stages rather than kicking in later. If you're on a pump or on your MDI, then you would take 50% less with your meal and 50% less corrections for generally up to two meals afterwards. If you've done an event that's, or some form of exercise that's longer than 90 minutes. So it is that missing window, but then it's a question of not just replacing it with exactly the same amount of insulin, otherwise you'll end up having a series of lows. Does that make sense?
Well, I think it does, yeah. Now we've led into the lows, which Tom has a few questions now that we've talked about the highs that can be associated with exercise.
Here we go. So why do hypos happen more frequently around sport and exercise and during, after, and during the night? And what can we do to maybe prevent these hypos?
So, I mean, we've talked about some of this. So there's two kind of reasons why hypos are, three reasons why hypos more often is, one is that when you're exercising, there tends to be a bit more insulin around than the normal case with someone who doesn't have type 1 diabetes. So the body gets a mismatch between how much glucose it produces and how much is being used, and that means the glucose falls. The second reason is that obviously you lose your glycogen stores, and a bit like what Nursarat was saying, was that actually what determines how fit you are is how much glycogen you have in your muscles. So an elite athlete will have, maybe 300% more than us in terms of glycogen in their muscle. So they can always get glucose immediately if they need it for their exercise, whereas some of us have to generate it from other places if we go for longer than sort of 2 hours or so. And if you get to the end of a training session, if you use your glycogen stores, the body gets fitter by making more glycogen, but it only has those signals around for about 3 hours after exercise. So the sooner you can eat carbohydrate and protein, then the more likely you are that you will build up your glycogen stores. So that for elite athletes, it's clearly shown that if you, the earlier you get that in, and particularly, and with people with type 1 diabetes, they have a bit of an advantage, so they can give themselves a small a bit more insulin to generate that, so half a unit or something, just to really generate it, then you can build up, and that's worked very well for rowers and things, for really building up the stores much quicker. So the advantages, and it's one of the advantages we can use for people pre-season training. We say to them, try and break up your training, have lots of recovery where you take a bit of insulin, and actually they get fitter quicker. So you can use it to really help people with type 1 diabetes get fitter quicker. And then there's this insulin sensitivity stage where you're more insulin sensitive. And if you haven't filled up your glycogen, the it's taking from the glucose. So you're removing the glucose as well as your insulin working better. So lots of things going on that are predisposing you to have a low. In terms of dealing with it, I think Nursarat went on that over that really nicely, just said that. So we have what we call the ICE principles. So to prevent injury, you have ICE. So to prevent hyperglycemia, you can use ICE principle. So that's, you can either change the insulin. What we were talking about is reducing the insulin. You can either use carbohydrates. So very, very clear evidence, if you eat within the hour and you eat your correct amount of carbohydrate and protein that you burnt during the exercise, that you'll prevent yourself having hypos. And then the other things you can do is, but that only works for that hour after exercise, is if there's a worry that you might go low on your way home or things like that, or you're in a situation where you can't eat. And they're generally swimmers. So swimmers, when they get out of the pool, it's a bit strange to eat food when you're naked in the shower. People do look at you slightly strangely and kind of things. So what you can do is you can do a sprint, finish up your warm down with the sprint. That seems really odd, but that elevates your stress hormones, and that will protect you for 45 minutes or so. And that's actually a way of stopping lows during exercise as well. So you can use a sprint. So at the start of an event, if you're only going to go for a run for 40 minutes, you could just warm up, do a 10-second sprint, and that will cover you for the 40 minutes. We do have some people who do endurance events who just do a sprint every 40 minutes, and that's their method for keeping their blood glucose up. So I've had someone who finished a 110-mile run at the weekend and did a sprint every 40 minutes and managed to keep his blood sugar between 5.6 and 7 for the whole of the event. Wow. So that's worked very well. And that's the real eye-opener on our course, when we tell people that actually you can use exercise to keep to manage your glucose. If it gets slightly high after exercise, you just prolong the warm down. If it's slightly higher before, then you can just do a long warm up and just bring it down. And if it's starting to fall during exercise, you can do a sprint. Then that really kind of gives people real flexibility.
So interesting. Thank you so much. Do frequent hypos affect your performance or affect the improvements that you're seeing with exercise? So the more frequent you have hypos, do you think that will have impacts on your sort of performance?
So shall I take that? Maybe Nursarat might want to come in as well. So when you have a hypo, you're losing energy out of your liver, which is where your glycogen is stored. So it's difficult to maintain activity, because if you're having frequent hypos, when your next exercise, you're running on a liver which isn't fully restocked, so it's going to be difficult to perform without further hypos. So nutrition is really important as part of this, and people will find that they can't get their fitness levels up. They might start losing weight, all of these issues, if they're not adequate, not having sufficient nutrition, and having these hypos. So I don't know if Nursarat wants to come in and add to that.
Yeah, I think just as you've said, but it's just the silly things, isn't it? It's just the standard. Like if you're having to treat, if you're a swimmer and you're having a hypo, you're having to have treatment for that. If you're running and you're having to have constant hypos, if you were cycling, you know, just any sort of activity where you are having a hypo, just the physical times and slowing down and the annoyance. Yeah. And I guess from a safety point of view as well, it's probably not the safest if you're, I don't know, up a mountain and cycling. So yeah, just from safety as well, I think it can obviously, and it will affect your performance and it'll affect your time. So the better you can sort of manage your food and your sort of nutrition and your insulin as best as possible, you know, which is really tricky, isn't it? There's heat, there's fluid, there's food, carbohydrate. We've got a lot to think about. The time you've run, the amount of time you've sort of, the intensity. So there's a lot to think about. And
of course. Yeah,
I think if you're not sort of fueling adequately, you will notice it. So I think with what Rob said earlier as well, if you are doing that where you're sprinting, that will catch up with you at a later point. So you do need to be careful to make sure you've got some carbohydrate to replenish that. So if you're frequently having hypos at night and you've reduced your insulin, you've done as much as possible, I guess it is just trying to maybe trickle in some carbohydrate during the evening, or having something low GI food that can help sort of keep your sugars steady. So that can help. But obviously with all the new technology now, you can reduce down your insulin quite a lot. So I think I would focus on that. If you're on MDI, then I guess food is probably going to need to be something you think about. So having some carbohydrate, and rather than having a big portion of something in the evenings, if you know you frequently have them, it might be better to have like a smaller trickle and just have a couple of crackers and something, and then something else, that sort of thing. So yeah, just it's really not easy to manage, I would say, and I think it definitely does affect your performance.
Yeah, and I always say to my athletes is if you want to win, 80% of it is nutrition and 20% of it is your training. So in my clinic, the person who sorts all the problems out is the dietitian. If you get the diet right, and particularly making sure you're having enough across 24 hours, which was Nursarat was talking about, from doing an hour a week to 3 hours a week, the amount of carbohydrate you need goes up by 3 times, which is quite amazing. But also your protein requirements go up. And if you don't get that right, then you really start to run into difficulties. So it's really key to, you know, if you're having a bit of difficulty, first place of knowledge is the dietitians.
Thank you so much. What about guys? Is there any sort of points of reference that you'd recommend people to maybe go have a look at or to find out more information? I know we will be catching up again in September for another diabetes chat as part of a series of chats with you guys. But is anything you feel in the meantime that guys could go check out a little bit more information about exercise or nutrition?
If there is, we can put some links on diabeteschat.net as well.
Of course we can.
Yeah, so there's RunSuite, which I'm sure everybody knows. Our website, XTOD, has some information. For nutrition, I don't know what Nursarat to use, but the Australian site, Australian dietitian site, has some very nice information for people with type 1 diabetes. That's done in really quite nice language and some nice kind of downloads that you can get, which I think is a really nice place. And then there's X-Carbs as well, which is a website that talks about carbs for exercise. I don't know what Nursarat uses.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Sadly, we don't have as much in the BDA as yet on ours. So the Australian one is very good. I think, is it My Diabetes My Way? There's some information on there. And I think most websites now, a lot of the companies will have their own information. Or for anyone younger, you can use things like DigiBeats. They've got some really good stuff on there. And I guess even if you're not younger, you might have access to them. They do have some videos that they've put on. Otherwise, Carbs and Cals is some really good YouTube videos online. They also talk about the low GI, high GI and different types of foods and carbohydrates. So they're quite short. So they're always a good place to start if you're just looking for short videos.
Fantastic stuff, guys. Maybe just to finish off our evening, what are your top tips for training in hot weather with hot heat, especially right now with us in the UK with a heat wave? What would be your go-to couple of tips for people listening?
I'll go first if you want. So my three tips would be: one, that fluid, make sure you fill up before. And I think it's the one thing that I struggle with all my athletes are doing, is because I think they think that running or doing things with a fluid in their stomach is going to be difficult on things. But make sure that over the sort of hour before going, you're just regularly sipping up water and getting 300 to 400 mils in. Try exercising in the morning. One, it will make the whole thing simpler, but we also know that you're more likely to regularly exercise if you do your exercise in the morning, because quite often if you leave it to the evening and you've had a bad day, then you need much more strength of will to go out and do it. And then probably on these kind of days, think about maybe doing something you get as much benefit as continuous, but it's much shorter. So just doing a HIIT that's just kind of brief but it is quite quick, but you're not being exposed to the hot atmosphere for as long.
So I'll just add to that. So remember, also in hot weather, you're more likely the insulin absorption will be quicker because there's more blood going to your skin surface. and therefore just be aware of that, check more regularly, think about reducing the dose if you need to, and just be more wary of hypoglycemia in warm weather. And the other thing is just generally, keep it enjoyable. So start gently, see if there's any, make it social, so that find a way to keep it going. If there's a social element to it, more people are more likely to go. And start gently as well, and gradually crank it up as you go.
Yeah, mine would be, I guess, in the warmer weather, just finding some drinks that you can tolerate, that you like. I guess trying to make your own sort of milkshakes with ice cream, or sort of blending your own fruit ice lollies, making your own sort of ice lollies with no added sugar drinks can be really nice. And just thinking about your electrolytes as well, I guess you'll be losing a lot of fluid and other salts as well. So just mixing and having some extra salt and other bits and pieces into your day will be good as well. With trying to find things that you like, I think try find foods and snacks that you think you can snack on, and sort of plan quite well, I think, ahead. So sort of thinking about your day and your exercise and what you're going to do, especially if it's a long one. So sort of before, during, after, having to think about snacks and foods you can have. Even if you just go online and look for low GI foods or snacks, there's lots of information out there. So you should sort of be able to find a combination that works for you. So yeah, just finding something that you enjoy and getting used to that. It's always tricky, isn't it, to find decent snacks and hypo treatments that you don't get bored of, I guess, if you guys are having hypos.
The other thing, just, I'm an old man, so things come to me later. The other thing where you can get is a really good, if people like reading a book, is a book called The Diabetic Athlete. So that does nutrition for each of the sports, which is done by Sherry Kohlberg. So that's a really nice book where you can look up different nutrition for different sports.
Well, thank you so much, Nusrat, Parth and Rob, for coming on today and talking to the Diabetes Chat community and sharing such a insightful chat. Chris, I know you're on the panel. It's been really, really helpful, and we appreciate it, and we look forward to connecting up with you guys in a couple of months' time, where we'll chat some more.
Oh, thank you very much for the invite, and really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You're welcome. I hope that you can enjoy the rest of the evening and have a nice cold drink in this hot weather.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
Cheers, guys.
See you later.
Bye.